questions. I think the first question on both Astrid and my list was, can we kill Blaze Arcadia so we can all go home? We heard about a number of Lyman Alpha talks now already, and other talks, and the question is it going to be possible with those to disprove or to prove that Blaze Arcadia is occurring? And as an aside, what's necessary to make that happen?
Disprove is hard because you guys have enough freedom to keep the IGN less, right?
Does the user rate by factor of three and just fine?
Is a factor of three all you need?
And it's pretty marginal detecting it, as you can see from, for example, Barton's talk, even for your like standard model. So.
Is it going to be marginal for the next decade?
Possibly not.
Even if you could have all the telescope time you wanted to have run the observing program you were dreaming of, would you still have that problem?
So maybe, like if you could dream, you could put a giant UV telescope in orbit and get redshift 2 UV lined up before us. Maybe that would help, like really high signal noise.
Mm-hmm. The superlative class of telescopes, the extra large telescope, overwhelmingly large telescope, the 30 meter telescope, which is cutting off by now, a feverish dream.
But how should you?
No, but those are ground based, those are very big. Those won't help. You need to get above the atmosphere.
But how should you ever do anything else and put an upper limit on it?
So this might be a question for those of us working on Blaze Arcadia. At what point do we throw up our hands and say lasers are not contributing substantially to the heat budget of the black medium? Right. I suppose if you constrained it to less than 10% effect, it stops being interesting as a contributor, right? Maybe it still happens for other reasons.
I mean, would like the next generation of really large telescopes help in terms of basically getting very, very precise multiple sightlines to multiple radar sightlines? Would that make things better or worse? Or would we still be in a situation where, like, yeah, there may be some evidence for extra heating at low densities?
You start to do actually grids of quasar sidelines and actually do gene cycle analyses.
You may be able to establish if the voids are actually hot or not.
Yeah. You cross-correlation study.
But this sort of this wouldn't be killing it. That would be the opposite. It may be sort of collecting further evidence.
You could determine that the voids are actually completely cold, and then you would kill it in that way.
Then you would have decreased the lower upper limit somewhat.
Yeah.
Could you imagine if you have a grid of quasar sidelines, if you do a cross-correlation study, let's say a galaxy distribution, that you devise a specific statistics to sort of pick on the low density regions and to actually go, what you're basically similar to what you did, you pumped up this one data point into three data points, but if you do this in a smart way, spatially resolved, and then the device statistics to creep out the signal in the low density regions.
So this is the brightest known quasar in the sky.
But if you have.
So this grid thing, what do you do with faint quasar?
But the bigger telescopes, the which may be affordable actually doing this. I mean 42 meter ELT. So how long would the same observation take on ELT that you did now?
It would take an hour. But if you want to have a grid, you have to go to 3 magnitude fainter quasars. So you're immediately back to
it's
to where you are in Earth.
But it could be done, right?
Realistically, I think you'd rather get a few more of these. I think doing a grid to get to these low densities will be very difficult.
Is there anything we can hope for from the very local temperature? Because it seems to be clear that if it's blazer, it's 35K now, and if it's not blazer, it's 30K now. So that seems to be it's an order of magnitude. Any, is there anything that would kill it?
So, regarding your fluctuations, so you're putting fluctuations on 50, 100 megaparsec scales in the heating of the IgM. And this is somewhat indirectly, but it's affecting galaxy formation. Yeah. And so these are linear scales, like where we measure the clustering of galaxies very well. So you could imagine. I think this is difficult, but you can imagine comparing or looking for deviations in the clustering of galaxies from expectations, and then you would have trends as a function of the population of galaxies that you're correlating, especially if this is causing the void phenomena that was alluded to.
Didn't you argue that often the halos that lead to structures in those scales?
Oh, I'm not talking about dwarfs now, but you're getting the IgM to, is it 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 Kelvin at low?
It's more 30, 50, 1000. So it's 10 to the 4, yeah.
It's 10 to the 5, you're
in
the voids.
Oh, in the deep voids?
The deep voids are important, yes, so it's 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6, depending on the density.
Yeah. So this is affecting accretion onto smaller than the Milky Way's icy low, but I guess I think with dwarfs, so you can't do this exercise with dwarfs, you just don't see them far enough away. But if there is some indirect effect on galaxy formation on Milky Way mass halo sizes, where you're measuring to much, much better than a percent the clustering of those galaxies, then there could be, especially since it is on these large scales. Like small scales, how galaxies trace underlying matter is uncertain, but on 100 megaparsec scales, we think we understand it.
So playing devil's advocate, people could say it's AGN feedback, not voice tidal feedback.
100 megaparsec scale?
No, 100 maybe not, but I mean, 40-50, I mean, Yuk Shai claims actually the impact of AGN feedback actually propagates to very large kids in parts of the
but I think if you do this in correlation function space, it's actually very small scale, so the power spectrum makes it go to very much lower k, but yeah. So I think then the blast waves from AGN never make it further than a megaparsec.
The realistic ones, yes.
That depends a little bit on the environment, right? You can have large clusters where it goes somewhere. I think the largest known jet is something like 4.5 megaparsecs.
Yeah, so giant radio galaxies are head to head in 4.5 megaparsecs.
Yeah.
Those little groups, very clusters.
Yeah, I'm thinking of if you just inject a set off Taylor blast wave and ask how far that travels in Hubble time, it doesn't go that far. But for these jets, could they go further?
The feedback's more complicated than bombs.
Yeah, sure. But that's what the simulations are doing.
I know. Well, that raises a very important point, which is, we're talking about what kind of observational developments there might be. Is it clear that it's not the theoretical developments that are required? So I have better modeling of Lyman-Alpha spectra, or would anyone believe an effect, a small effect, on galaxy formation in the absence of a very well-defined theory of galaxy formation that's empirically successful?
I think I wouldn't believe it from my simulations, at least if it's a global effect. Like, we have all these efficiency parameters that we don't really understand it. If you have some new parameter that lifts galaxy formation by 10% in one or the other direction, or gives you 10% more blue than red galaxies, so, or vice versa, we wouldn't believe it. But I think the key is that if laser heating does something very specifically to very specific regions, and there has, so even if overall it contributes only a small amount of the energy budget, but if it does something very specifically in very specific regions, which I think then that would be hard to, or I think that's where we'd be looking for. So not trying to reduce the number of, let's say, satellite galaxies by 10% or so, because we're nowhere near that precision. We don't even know the mass of the Milky Way to that precision. So I think, I would look for those regions where laser feedback is disproportionately effective, like in Voyager, and try that, because we don't have anything. So we apply our standard models that are calibrated not in Voyager to them, and then add laser feedback. I think that's where I would hope to see some difference.
So look at galaxy growth in Voyager and outside of Voyager.
Yes,
and look for evidence of less growth or less.
And maybe
growth.
Also, so I think with the next generation of sort of 8-1 surveys, maybe we could not look at, let's say, the stellar mass function voids, which is highly separated, but also, for example, the 8-1 mass function or the 8-1 plus function, which it's much. I think star formation can happen at any time during the evolution itself, regulated by feedback and maybe regulated by laser heating. But whether or not these tiny galaxies can hold onto the gas, I think that might depend more on the current radiation field that they are experiencing. And so maybe we find, for example, that in voids, well, there's already in the Alpha survey, they find very few. Or the 8-1 function in voids seems to be suppressed. I mean, that's the entrance of voids problem. And if that holds up even with surveys that can probe much, much lower 8-1 masses, and the effect should be even stronger. And maybe that would be something. So rather than looking for the stellar mass function, maybe the gas fraction could be more effective. It's pure speculation.
I've just looked at Astrid's paper again. I simply don't actually show a map of the temperature fluctuations.
Isn't there the same map of the slice that I showed?
You show a map of the heating rate fluctuations.
Yes, not of the temperature fluctuation.
But not of the temperature fluctuation.
No.
So in principle, what sort of these large surveys will do is at some stage they will pick up at the UV fluctuations. So these Sloan-like surveys, that come afterwards, so they will at some stage pick up the UV fluctuations, sort of in addition to the density fluctuations, especially at large scales. I think the constants looked into this. And sort of you predict temperature fluctuations that should translate into the UV fluctuations as well. You would have just very carefully model what you get from the helium ionization as well, and look if actually sort of the power spectrum of the temperature fluctuation looks different from what you get from helium ionization. Because what they will pick up is sort of, there won't be any UV fluctuations. Well, there's a mixture of what can do the UV fluctuations. At some stage, they will just see the source clustering as well, despite the fact that the mean free path is very large. The UV background is very smooth. But at some level, you even see that there are more galaxies in one region than in others, despite the strong mean free path. But on top of this, they should pick up the temperature fluctuations as well. So they should, at some stage, pick up what you get from helium ionization. But your temperature fluctuations should be in the mix there too. They have no feel sort of what contributes and what scales. But if you basically can dominate the larger scales, then you might actually have a signal there, and I don't know how long we have to wait till we can do this, that you can really dig that out. But I think the papers looked at, sort of Andrew Ponson, who has looked at what the source clustering does, despite the mean free path, if you're actually getting sensitive enough. So these are sort of percent level UV fluctuations.
This is a 3D Lyman Alpha Forest measurements that I guess, speaking to this a little, these measurements are also, like, most of these equations are really just above redshift 2. So it's at redshifts that are well suited for planar heating potentially. The big issue here is the and I'm not sure that these will ever be measured, in that it depends on how well they understand things like their continuum and the long wavelength modes in there. They have to. These surveys are looking for this BAO bump, like in the 3D clustering, and to understand the trends in the continuum fluctuations under this BAO bump are much harder for them, and so they haven't come close to being able to measure how that scales with and these continuum fluctuations. I'm not talking about the continuum of the quasar. I'm talking about just that you have a BAO and then you have some correlations. And so right now they just subtract like some really high order polynomial from their data and then find for the continuum and then find the BAO peak. And so it's a question of whether they can actually measure these small effects on large scales, which is a matter of like how well they understand their continuum subtraction and their instrument.
So what you're saying is there's a great deal of theoretical development prior to observational development to make use of that.
You guys should definitely predict what it looks like.
The positive thing is they basically have to do this. So what they do one survey after another to get the BAOs more precise and more precise and more precise. So they have now to worry about what sort of, at a sort of small level, can shift the position of the BAO peak by sort of being superposed. So they will have to understand this, because if they want to go on, so they basically, what you sort of may predict is sort of for them a nuisance parameter that they have to eliminate and understand in the process.
So they can solve the problem for us?
This is not normally how it works. If it looks complicated, this is normally ignored as long as possible.
So why did temperature fluctuation show in UV fluctuation?
Because of the recombination coefficient.
Right.
It's not in the UV fluctuation, but in the flux.
Ah.
In the flux.
Yes.
It's not in the UV, but in the flux. It's a temperature and the UV that goes in, but you can get flux fluctuations.
So it's just from recombination?
Just from the recombination.
And that's sensitive to temperature?
This is sensitive to temperature.
So I guess you need to produce temperature. Yeah. So shifting gears. We've heard a number of talks now about plasma theory, and we've heard some discussion surrounding those. So let me throw out a contentious question. Given that we just talked about the state of observation and whether or not we can falsify in one particular way laser heating model, can plasma theory make confident, verifiable predictions in the nonlinear regime? That is, if Mohammed or I or Reinhard or Jean-Luc or Federico or Phil came to you and said, we've solved the problem, here's the answer, or Antoine, I'm sorry, I think we've got. I don't know. It'll be none of us, probably. I say, we solved the problem, here's the answer. Would you believe it? What do you need to see to believe it? And how do we go about doing that?
No. Well, speaking of theorists, in principle, Federico came off the, we did the experiment, and here's the answer. Believe it.
First of all, I don't do experiments myself, but I think that's actually a question I'm very interested in the answer. I mean, if you can either full-scale or first-principle simulation, or even better, an experiment in the lab where, let's say, you have a relativistic electron-positive beam, it's not going to be with a gamma of a million, but let's say with a gamma of 10 or 100, propagating in a denser hydrogen plasma. And you can measure experimentally the slowdown of the beam. Let's say that given this distance, this beam loses 30% of its energy. What would be the impact of such a result for astrophysical thinking for this problem, but also for other problems where this could be relevant? I mean, I'm very curious to know what the answer to that is.
So
definitely the underlying basic physics is the same, and we can, that same process can be scaled between different environments. But of course, things are much more complicated in astrophysics because not only it's not just a game of 10 or 100, but maybe you can have arguments for that. But now we have the radiation that is leading to all sorts of other problems. The density is not like a uniform plasma. It can have very large variations over these very long distances. So what do you guys think, that how would such a result be received in the industrial physical community?
I think, Brad, you looked at this at some point for inertial quantum fusion, right? Have they done experiments? Basically, you basically study this exact parameter gene, beam density ratio of 10%, and then like gamma of like a few. So is there any contact with the experiment results, theory and experiment?
Yeah, there is some work on laser plasmas where people claim that they, if you believe in this MHC scaling, that they can simulate the same situation as in supernova remnants or supernova remnants. And they see clear evidence for this filamentation stability. I think Antoine had this, we had this citation from this Hutchinson 2015 paper. Somebody had it.
Yeah, I'm involved in that. I'll show it tomorrow.
On the first day.
Yeah, I'll show it tomorrow.
And Luca Gregory from Oxford, he's a high energy density community. This is a similar problem that they are looking at.
Yeah, so for instance, for the filamentation instability, that's why I'm asking this. We have now experimental evidence that when you collide two collisionless counter-streaming plasmas, you generate magnetic field, filament magnetic fields at nearly the partition, a few percent of the energy, kinetic energy of the beams. There is now experimental demonstration of that with benchmarking 3D simulations that try to model the entire system. My point is, if you should do something similar for this problem in 5 years, let's say, what would be the impact on the lab? I mean, I know what would be the impact in the lab, because, I mean, we are driving this stuff, but I have no idea if people think this is relevant or just, okay, that's interesting from the point of view of understanding plasma physics, but also physics is so much more complicated that I cannot use that result so easily.
Also, so one thing that this could apply to is cosmic rays created by population of young pulsars in the centers of galaxies. Right? So anywhere where we have some source of charged particles plowing through a soft radiation field, the same sorts of questions we're talking about arise.
I'm not so sure about the response from the astrophysical community. So normally they hate this stuff. It's much too complicated for them. So they're all trained with hydrodynamics and MHD. And if you tell them, well, you can't apply that because the plasma parameter is so small, so your distribution functions are not Lexlerian, so you cannot use normal equations, you cannot use ideal MHD, then they sort of get mad. So that's, and I know, I mean, from in our university, people that go for astronomy, they really do that to avoid these complicated maths and theoretical physics. So you should not, I mean,
in all fairness,
you should regard yourself as a maverick, but not as a well-received astrophysicist. But in the solar wind community, I mean, hydrodynamic models all fail. They all have given it up. So they all do kinetics. So the wind plasma is comparable to the interstellar plasma. But in astrophysics, people can still get away with it. I mean, because there are less observations, you cannot really pin it down. But this is definitely the future. And I thought you really opened the Pandora's box with your papers, that now the cosmologists probably also have to think about kinetic effects. But I would predict that they don't like it. Mm-hmm. We just wait long enough, all these effects will damp away, and then we can do our hydrodynamics. And we can explain it without your laser heating. We heard
if you can't,
we can explain it without it. We don't need it.
The plasma community will damp this way. That's the whole thing.
You see, the majority of plasma physicists also not interested in this stuff. They work on these fusion plasmas. So except from these laser plasma people, but they're not, they want to build ether, so they're not interested in these sort of physics. So they have no experience there.
Kind of to MHD, you better forget about the magnetic fields altogether.
Well, I remember seeing the evolution of astronomical theory. Step one, invoke magnetic fields, and then there are a bunch of random steps. And step 15, you no longer need magnetic fields, right? Well, there has been a lot of development on simulation and theory in these other contexts. And one of the reasons why I think astrophysicists use hydrodynamics, we were just talking about this a few minutes ago, is because it's so well under control.
We understand
exactly what we're doing then.
If you do resistive MHD or anomalous MHD, where your viscosities and heat conduction coefficients are far away from the ideal ones, that's fine, because MHC equation is still lower, just energy conservation of mass equation. But you should not use ideal MHC.
And
you're completely wrong.
Well, frequently, you can get away with using an ideal MHD because the scales are so far separated in astrophysical systems. And then people get answers and they believe them. Is there a path in plasma astrophysics, towards getting to a point where we can do these nasty nonlinear problems either numerically or analytically or semi-analytically and have widespread confidence that we've gotten it right and the next student to come along is going to completely invalidate everything that we just said, right?
Well, with fixed simulations, you can in principle test everything. These are numerical experiments, so all the physics are included except collisions.
I thought that was true a long time ago, but I don't believe that anymore.
3-dimensional simulations in velocity and in position, you see all the effects, but you have to understand what the computer is telling you, because nothing is neglected in a way, except from collisions.
Well, collisions can be, just so that collisions can be put in big simulations, actually.
Well,
I would say except for quantum effects.
So you think we can do PIC simulations in principle, where we actually approximate each electron and forget about quasi particles, we do particles.
But I think those are the problems. So I think you can use PIC simulations with confidence to model these effects from first principles. But the issue is the issue of the scales. Okay? I mean, if you look at the Bruce Lehman book, I mean these big codes, they were developed to run 1,000 time steps or something like that. Now people are trying to run them for 10 million time steps, okay? And so there's challenges. There's challenges associated with that. And so, of course, as you try to push these algorithms for very long scales, spatial and temporal scales, you need to be aware of what are the numerical issues that we're going to face and how to deal with them. Okay, but provided that you can deal with those numerical issues, I think they're trustworthy. And more you have, for instance, in the laser plasma community, people trying to do direct comparison, including myself, of experiments and simulations that not only understand the experiment, but can benchmark the codes. Okay, and this has been done, like Jean-Luc has been doing that for many years in the laser wave field acceleration or the accelerator community, doing that stuff also in the laser solid like plasma interaction community. So there's a lot of people doing benchmark of the codes with actual experiments. Now, I think using a particle in cell simulation to try to model scales that are relevant to astrophysics, for the majority of these problems, I think that's going to be insane. So I think you need first of all to understand what is the basic physics, and then try to see if you can use that understanding
to have better algorithms that they can try to couple the scales. Like people are doing these hybrid simulations where they try to couple this kinetic with more MHD scales. I mean, if you understand what are the basic kinetic processes that you need to capture, then you can develop these hybrid algorithms with confidence that you are still capturing the dominant processes. So I don't think the answer is easy. That, I mean, even if you can model some of these problems in a big simulation, there's still, I think, a big step to the astrophysical scales that you need to be careful about.
Let me ask you, you cannot handle these low density ratio of 10 to the minus 15.
I think we'd be happy to be able to handle density ratios of 10 to minus 4. That's still very difficult.
It's still difficult because a lot of money and computer power can be done.
But regarding the benchmark, so how does that go? What kind of accuracy are FICTOs regularly reproducing experiments?
I mean, it depends on from field to field, I think. But Joel can comment on this as well. But I can say that, for instance, within codes, there's been lots of efforts, for instance, in the laser wave field community, in Jammu, people from UCLA, from other teams, they have multiple efforts to try to compare these codes in detail and make sure that the results are consistent across different codes with different implementations. In terms of experiments, also, again, it depends from fields to fields. Laser wave field, there's nowadays numerous examples, like basically all experimental paper tells us the condition that it needs to have 3D simulations to simulate the experiment in a paper these days. So basically all the laser wave field exploration papers these days have experiments and 3D simulations comparing with experimental results. And in general, the agreement is pretty good.
Qualitatively or quantitatively?
Quantitatively.
Both, yeah. So I thought NIF was getting things to a factor a few or something.
So NIF is different. So this is laser wave field, which is like under dense plasmas.
Yeah.
Now, if you go to over dense plasmas, where basically the laser light cannot penetrate, so optical light cannot penetrate the target, things are a bit more complicated because typically it's hard to look inside the plasma experimentally. And so you rely kind of on indirect measurements. So you measure what comes out of the plasma. You do a simulation. In the simulation, you can see what's inside and what's outside. You try to match what comes out to understand what happened inside. And so these efforts are there as well, showing promising results, but it's not the exactly direct comparison, so it's a bit more difficult. When you talk about NIF, usually I think you're talking about biodynamic simulations, which it's true that in several regimes, in particular the ones that are more relevant for ignition, aerodynamic simulations seem not to match the experimental results. But I think that's one more evidence, at least that's what I hope, that kinetic effects are also important in these fusion plasmas if you hit them in conditions where you expect to have fusion. And so if you just use aerodynamic simulations, why would you expect?
I thought these were quick simulations that were being described. They were very. The speaker, whose name I have now former director, now forgotten, was describing quick simulations.
But then that's probably like the viscosity and energy transfer issue.
All I remember hearing was things wrong with that factor.
So in a simulation, you have to know all the parameters of the system very well. So this is. These are plasmas, you know exactly how big it is, how long, and what's in the field.
Yeah.
In astrophysical systems, we don't know that. So we're just assuming something, and different people assume different things, and this might be completely wrong. I mean, one should only invest lots of computing power if you know the system very well. And in the beginning, you should just do theory, simple-minded theory to figure out what other relevant effects. And then if you have pinned it down, then you can do a simulation. And all these, what we heard, how you interpret blazar SED, and we can run a whole meeting, and you could see what people assume and which is reasonable, and other people will say, well, this is completely wrong, we can't do that. So it all depends on these answers. But I think this laser heating problem will remain, because I'm really sure that we have a problem with these inverse Compton-Gamma rays that are not seen. So we have to figure out why we don't see this GV emission from these sources. And I personally think that there has to be some intrinsic absorption, photon-photon absorption, with target photon fields in the X-ray range. So there will be a dip in the GV spectrum. And on the power law, what everybody assumes when he calculates the efficiency in pairs. So that will not go away, especially if you have a beam contribution and the lost time for inverse Compton may be even smaller than the given isotropic distribution. We have to look into this problem.
But can you use that to make a minimal model? Sort of to add up what you don't see in gamma rays, what has to go in heating?
Yeah. But these radar sources are the most crazy sources that you find. I mean, they're varying in time and frequency and not even understood whether it's the radiation is done by hadrons or by leptons, and whether it's synchrotron or synchrotron self-Compton or external Compton or nonlinear synchrotron self-Compton. You know, all these models predict something different. So I seem to be very careful, and I would not believe in these simple these HBL arguments that those that have a high frequency synchrotron peak are the predominant TV sources. This can all be explained in a completely different way. So even that is not understood. It's these high energy radiation processes.
So you're saying you don't think it's obvious that the high synchrotron peak sources correspond to the TV sources? So that's an empirically verifiable statement, right? Aren't TV sources, by and large, except for crazy things like M87, HSPs?
Well, that way it works, but the other way is not so obvious. I mean, there are a couple of HBLs that we haven't found.
Okay.
Wait,
I'm going to get the direction right. You said the other day that every TEV source has been found by Fermi, including ones that weren't found a month ago.
Yep.
But the other direction doesn't come. Okay, can I ask just a quick question of the gamma ray community? Once upon a time, there were HBLs. And then there became HSPs. And is this just, you know, a plan to confuse the uninitiated? Or, I mean, how should I be matching these together? I understand the HSPs are designated from optical.
It's basically because of a fight about this optical spectrum, which I think for these purposes is probably irrelevant. There may or may not be a small fraction of these guys that have quasar lines. So you don't want to call them BLX because BLX don't have quasar lines. I'm not sure that matters.
But I thought LSPs, ISPs, and HSPs were spectral designations, independent of the source type. You're saying HBLs, because BL is BLX.
Yes.
Okay, is an HBL the same as an HSP then?
It is a subset, if you want to be very particular, yes.
So every HBL is an HSP?
Yeah. It's kind of an old term at this point. I mean, people don't really use HBLs, but yeah, that's...
Well, because it's not obvious that just because you have high synchrotron peak, you have a hard gamma ray spectrum.
That's what I was saying. I mean, I think we have a couple of sources which are high frequency peak, whether it's BLX or something other, that we have not found in gamma rays.
Yeah, there are some where the Compton peak is weirdly close to the synchrotron peak. That happens.
So, I mean, I would believe it's still... all the plate, I second Reinhardt's comment. I think if you basically throw a synchrotron SED at people and ask them to predict the gamma ray or the inverse Compton analog of that, you still have basically as much freedom as you have in the entire population. And so people come up with a model explaining whatever you see, but if you turn it into being predictive, right, give them the synchrotron SED and ask them to come up with a decent model for the gamma rays without telling them stories. They won't do a good job on that.
So what was your detection efficiency previous to Fermi? That's only based on the X-ray. So you look basically where the X-ray was.
Well, you can do that, but that's basically turning into bright sources are bright sources. I mean, if you go for the X-ray brightest things, right, they will ultimately likely be the gamma ray brightest things. But it's really as simple as that. I mean, if you go to the old predictions in the early days of Fermi, where people were plotting X-ray flux with something or other and came up with predictions on what the bright sources were, it boiled down to bright sources are bright sources, right? I mean, which amongst the Bialak objects basically means nearby objects are nearby objects. I mean, it sounds bad, but that's what it was. And I think, I mean, that is true for the time average spectra. And to make matters worse, if you then ask them to do the same thing for time variable surfaces, it's not going to improve.
So I have a question. So Irene mentioned that, like, we found these hostile extra populations who in total might dominate the TV budget. Right.
Yes.
Now, if that's true, how much wiggle room is there in the actual like gamma ray background to allow the adoption to exist?
That's a really good question, and we haven't looked yet. But it's an obvious thing to do,
okay.
it may in fact indicate that this can't be very common. For example, so there are other quasar jets that don't have a very strong X-ray excess, maybe only slight excess or none. So that. It may just be some very weird particular process in these.
Yeah. Or it may indicate that there are no cascades.
Yeah, that too. If it's if we for example start finding that these guys should be producing tons of TV emission and then you say nothing in the GV spectrum, then yeah, it makes that an even more strong constraint.
Except in this case, the flux is presumably somewhat less, right? As you're distributed over much. Do you have an idea of what kind of opening angle? I think I said something wrong earlier. I think the hardest was the arm narrow.
Yes.
Factor.
Yes. I don't know off the top of my head, but it's something we will be calculating and putting in this paper that we're writing. So. It's going to be a factor of several more than the TVBLX, certainly.
So then, and what does the spectrum look like? Would they have to be much softer in the VOI?
They will be hard in the TEV band. So they might be harder. I'd have to look again at the typical TEV source. But we don't know where the synchrotron spectrum cuts off. We don't have any more high resolution instruments. Presumably not much further beyond the Chandra band, or it starts to become. Again, weird for synchrotron emission, but I still think this should carry you up to being very hard through all the instruments we currently have. So, yeah, that cutoff is unfortunately going to be difficult to observe.
So they're all too faint for asteroid HMD stuff.
It's not the faintness, it's the resolution.
Right.
Yeah. If we can find one of these guys operating more than 30 arc seconds from the core, we could try a new star.
So then that comes back to this energy budget or flux budget for halos. So Margaret, you were saying that there was an argument for only expecting 10% of the GeV-ish or 50 GeV-ish flux coming from halos. I look perplexed. I think Jim looks a little perplexed. Is that still true here? I mean, if we have three times the total luminosity in FSRQs, I would guess you would expect of order 50%.
That's per object, right? So again, we don't know anything about number density.
FSRQ. Is it? Yeah, this was the total luminosity, right?
Glass.
Sorry.
But when you said three-ish times the luminosity from BLX, you mean as a population, the total population of SRQs would have three times the TV luminosity.
Okay, yes.
The total population would be all that.
No, that's a completely unbounded problem right now, because all we know is that for these particular objects, we see between even two orders of magnitude more. Now, how that translates to the general population is, like I said, we have no idea. We don't have enough observations. Two sources is just impossible to extrapolate from.
So for two sources, they could be three times more luminous.
Yes.
Then two BLX.
Exactly. Okay. So it's a matter of how much you want to extrapolate. So if you want to say this actually carries over to the entire quasar population, that's your upper bound, I guess. But it's
one is a sample and two is a population.
Yes.
So should Hawk see those? I mean, Hawk looks at the Paris Kato, right?
Not nearly sensitive enough.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's sensitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, CTA is the only one.
But the other SRQs can be much further away. You're still going to get eaten up on the.
That's the other. Out. That's the other issue is that we are actually volume limited also for that. We might be able to get something out of Fermi.
So is the next galactic gamma ray background really the right place to look then? Should we be looking for halos? What do you think, Marco? What do you want to say?
What do you mean?
If there really is an enormous amount of TV emission potentially coming from FSIQs.
There are many places where to see it. You will start seeing a deviation in the XRP gamma ray background.
Right.
The current shape is fairly smooth, but it's systematically dominated. You will start seeing, if it's huge emission, you will start seeing about around a few GBs.
I guess the CTAs aren't ready to. The CTA will that do that better? I forget what the crossover was.
100 GeV, roughly, for the emissions.
100 GeV. Oh, okay. So then CTA.
Well, it depends how. Not for the whole sky,
of course. Right.
So when you, this is wrong for one deep observation, 8 degrees.
CTA deep field.
I mean, you'll get, your point, for example, at Perseus or something for a couple of 100 hours, right? So you'll get, there will be deep fields just at random based on people's favorite objects. If we want to do a deep field based on some existing deep field, which is probably a good idea.
The 300 hours now that you run through Perseus.
Yeah. In the south, of course, we'll be more sensitive, especially with a few TeV. So it's probably not the best. I mean, whether we should follow up on existing X-ray deep fields, for example, try and probe the faint AGA populations.
Can CTA principle be background? I mean, so far the technique was optimized for point sources or slightly extended sources, but I mean, can in principle, I mean, could you subtract point sources, could you actually get the background flux?
It's extremely difficult. I mean, is this turnover flux in the extragalactic background light, the flux of cosmic ray electrons is way above, and you can discriminate between gammas and electrons, but it's pretty hard, so I think we'll be in trouble trying to get the background.
You need to do the background subtraction to a rate of 10 to the minus 5-ish. I think even 10 to the minus 4 is difficult.
But it's
a very different game compared to them. And so if you just compare the rates of background events to gamma ray events, you're talking about 10 to 5, 10 to 4, 10 to 5.
Perhaps an extremely high energy, where you get sort of background free
issue. You can do it above a couple of
then you can
20 TV or thereabouts, but that's not the main
horizon of doses, I don't know. 1 or 2 megaparsecs.
There shouldn't be an isotropic 20 TV
background. There should be interesting TV coming.
So there is some wiggle room from in the gamma ray background interpretation at, say, below 10 GeV. That's because it's reproduced by other source classes, which the lab does not resolve nearly as good as lasers. So there's a gold star forming galaxies and radio galaxies. And these are all extrapolations from other bands, basically. Luminosity function from other bands that are adapted to the Fermi band. So errors are large. There are techniques in place to constrain the future, but it may turn out that those don't provide as much as we thought of the background, for example. For example, say around 1 GeV, that will leave like a place for a strong cascade component.
From very soft to sources.
Yeah, imagine.
Yeah. Where should we hit on next? 5 minutes. The other option is to break for the day and reconvene for dinner.
Well, I'll ask one question.
Oh, right. Cool.
The one question I ask is, I'm talking about dwarf galaxies, but are there better probes, are there better observation probes of structure formation that are sensitive to the IGM than dwarf galaxies?
Yeah, one more.
It seems pretty close to 0.5.
I asked a well-known plasma astrophysicist type, where would be the place to look? And he said the Lyman Alpha Force is there, the physics is absolutely clear and clean. So
who said that?
No, he's probably right. This is still our problem, right? But in terms of structure formation, like, well, anyway, so one thing that we thought initially was clusters, right? But is there something happened at M star galaxy, for instance?
I think what Teo said is a good point. If you go to the void, and then you see galaxies there, and the baryon fraction there is low, and also not much star formation there, then you would ask a question, what happened? Right? That in principle can be done, just look at H1 or.
I think constraints on structure formation on small scales, not just for the purpose of laser heating, but also, for example, for constraining warm black matter models. So they really mostly come from Lyman Alpha Force and from dwarf galaxies. And for the purpose of warm black matter, there's some competing constraints. I think the Lyman Alpha Force constraints are tighter because the physics is better understood. So the dwarf galaxies is more physics that we don't understand yet to come to a conclusion.
The only other probe there of flux radio anomalies in the lensing, but
yes.
Of course for the satellite distribution there, but which is would not be important for us. But
yes.
So that's a probe for the
yes.
dark matter subject of content.
Yes.
I think maybe the problem though is you say what's going on there. That's a very different thing than saying this or that process.
Going on. Well, if you cannot find anything else that can do the job in the your very low density region, then it's a blazer.
that reminds me of how to do the sun was preaching chocolate. Right, Sir Lord Kelvin and Helmholtz both were absolutely certain it was comets. Because there was no other source of power.
Yeah.
Chemical burning was ruled out, and clearly that was it.
But
it's a constellation to change that, right?
Yeah, but then the question is then how reliable the planets are heating, the prediction is, right? And then if you have a very clear prediction, I think then the chance, and then you don't have any other possibilities,
That should work. We have a prediction, right?
Yeah, that's
we have a prediction. The question is that, like, how sensitive is that prediction, right? How sensitive is structure formation to that prediction? And it does not sound horribly sensitive, right? Except for module design, variant environment variance.
Yes.
Which is also unclear to me if, like, no other effects cannot have something similar.
And even for us, it is a prediction. How reliable is that prediction?
If we find or not find, like.
Well, with that, very, very, very optimistic note.
Except for now, why would we interested in looking at looking at galaxies in voids and trying to see if they have anomalous evolution because of a hot IGN? It seems like a good approach.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The question is how well you can determine what's causing the atypical evolution.
I mean, I think there are other examples where environment does make a difference.
Yes, but then I mean, that's the advantage of voids that there's not that much. So in clusters, you have harassment and stripping and a hot halo of the cluster that can. But in voids, there's not that much.
So you can compare field voids.
And it's actually going the other way. You actually see more force in clusters. So when you have actually more abilities to destroy stuff, you see more. That's already, I think, a clear signature that something must be happening in the shipping spread. But something is actually the formation time, so that could be enough already. So,
you would compare something like the local environment, which is sort of not a cluster, but also not a void, to voids and
different. Okay, we can continue at dinner, and we can continue tomorrow. Thank you all.